subject, czy bez zaszczytki, bez woli, bez czynienia, bez jeszcze.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. My name is Ellie Morgan. This is a podcast I do typically with my podcasting partner, Peter Rollins, who is a philosopher and a writer. But Pete is not here today. He's in Northern Ireland doing a festival. I think it's Wake. I'm not entirely sure. I think it is from what I've seen on his Instagram. And Pete, I know you're going to be listening to this, and I just want you to know that I've slept in your bed, and you don't need to worry about the stains on the carpet or it's just animal blood, and it's going to be, the landlord said it'll be really easy to take out with some baking soda, and I miss you very much, and I'm sorry that you're not here. But what Pete and I have decided to do, since we are across the ocean, is each have a guest on the podcast, and in keeping with the theme of the Fundamentalists, we've brought on a guest in this particular episode who is way smarter than I am and way more well-versed in every area that I'm interested in and pretend to know a lot about, and so that people think that I'm smarter than I actually am. So today we have a professor and author, Todd McGowan, who, if you guys are listeners of the podcast, you know I've mentioned Capitalism and Desire about 18 different times because I have to mention the books that I'm reading, because otherwise if I don't, no one knows that I'm reading, and then what's the point in doing
it?
Yeah, exactly. So Todd, thank you for being on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
So I guess we'll start with kind of an introduction. I want people who are listening to know, you know, a little bit of your background, who you are, what you're into, what are your hobbies, all that fun stuff. Let's dive into the really heavy stuff first.
Okay, the heavy stuff first. Well, I think we have this in common. I grew up in a fundamentalist household, so that was that was, traumatic.
And, that was the source of the trauma.
Yeah, it was the original source of the trauma. And then I my dream was to be a monk when I was in high school. So that was,
when you were in high school?
Yeah. That. When I was in high school, yeah. Yeah, which my high school girlfriend didn't think was a very cool, cool dream.
What kind of fundamentalist household, if you know?
Well, so that's interesting. So it was a sort of a non-denominational fundamentalism, but then I converted to Catholicism myself in high school.
Wow, what a rebel.
I know.
Going for it.
Yeah, it was a real act of rebellion.
What did your parents, go after you.
No, go ahead. My dad was pissed.
Okay, that's
my mom. Yeah, and then my mom, and he was most pissed because my mom sort of followed my lead and converted herself, and then he said to me, I spent my life determined never to marry a Catholic, and now you've made it so that I am married to one. And he goes, and I'll never forgive you for that. So that was, he was really a nice guy. He wasn't a bad, that was one of his few times he ever said, I won't forgive you.
Yeah.
So,
That sounds like sounds like definitely the very thing that would immediately get you into psychoanalysis. It would spark that interest.
That interest actually. But then in college, this for him was even worse. I had a Marxist conversion, which was my real conversion away from sort of religiosity, and that was for him really like he was a real conservative, and so that was. That was traumatic.
Yeah, I'm sure him. I can understand that. I think I might be. I don't think I'm converted, but I'm flirting for sure.
Yeah.
Full disclosure, I'm very nervous about this podcast only because I know Pete is much more well versed in the subjects that I'm sort of going to ham handedly try to dive into.
Sure.
Please forgive any dumb things that I say.
No. I don't. I'm just, everyone's an amateur.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah. I'll take that. I'll put it. I'll use that to comfort me for the next.
Hour. Yeah, it comforts me. I have to say.
Yeah. So when was your conversion or your Marxist conversion, as you call it?
So that was like my freshman year of college, and then sort of the interest in psychoanalysis was in graduate school. So I like things like Hegel and Freud and Lacan, that those figures were important for me in graduate school. And so I kind of drifted away from Marx, I would say. I mean, not politically necessarily, just as a theoretical.
Yeah.
Foundation. So.
I was listening to a podcast that you did when you were talking, I believe, about capitalism and desire, and you were it was a psychoanalysis podcast. I think it's called Psychoanalysis or something like that.
Yeah, I think
so. And before we dive into, because I want to talk about a particular scene in the movie Drive, but you mentioned in there, and I didn't finish the podcast because I get distracted easily, but there's a part in it where you said that I should say this for later, but there's a part in it where you basically say that, and I don't know if this is a result of the Marxist conversion or whatever, but you mentioned that if there was $1 million across the street, you wouldn't go walk across the street to get it. Why wouldn't you do that, Todd?
I just don't, I feel like I have enough money, and I don't think it's like I'm a, it's not like I'm a saint or anything. It's just, it doesn't appeal to me. And if I ever think about getting, I just am not interested in accumulation, but I also feel like I can't stop thinking about at whose expense I have a lot. And so I, just for my own conscience, it's hard for me.
Yeah.
Have a lot, and so
that weighs on you, a little bit.
Yeah, it weighs on me. And I know, I understand, even from a Marxist perspective, that that's a kind of individualist, that kind of bad conscience, sort of individualist trap that it's what's needed is more societal change, and little individual actions don't really mean anything. But I can't help it. I just would feel bad.
That's great. I feel like that's a very admirable thing.
Yeah, I don't know. It's admirable or not.
I don't know.
I just don't want to, I'm constantly trying to fight them. They're trying to, so I have a weird relationship to our faculty union here, because obviously their struggle is to get our wages raised, and I feel like we make too much money. So I'm not it's funny because I'm a total leftist, but I'm not a very good union member. Like, I would never be on they wouldn't want me on the negotiating team.
That's hilarious.
Because, so I never go to the little rallies for more, I would go to a rally for whatever, academic freedom or
yeah,
whatever. But for more money, I just can't do it. So.
Are you?
I hope none of my colleagues are listening to this because they'll want me fired.
Well, maybe it's a way that they can dodge a bullet because, worst case scenario, they have you in that negotiating situation. I'm like, why do you deserve more money? And you're like, I don't know, man. I think I'm fine. I think I'm good, actually.
Yeah.
kind of nailed it. What, you're a professor now?
Yeah, I'm a professor.
And
yeah.
Where and what do you teach and
so I'm at the University of Vermont, and I'm a professor of film studies. So even though my PhD is in English, I sort of drifted over. It's not an uncommon drift,
right.
But sort of drifted over to film studies. So I teach, a few classes of just film history. But what I'm really interested in is evidence from what I write on is sort of just theoretical questions. So like right now I'm teaching a seminar on Marx and film noir. So it's just basically an excuse to read a ton of Marx and
watch a ton of film noir.
Yeah, I watch a ton of film noir. So I try to, I make the films fit, but I'll do things like one class I taught Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness with the teen film. So the film, I try to,
that's so cool.
I try to make it. Yeah, that was cool. The students really, they were pretty into that.
I noticed that in Capitalism and Desire, and I went through a phase where, and I think I think I have a disconnect that happens sometimes when I talk about these subjects because I'm not in that world at all, clearly. But I'm fascinated by it, and I found that when I'm actually discussing, these issues with people, for one, I can get heady and I can get kind of like, look at how much I know, and this person that I can name that, yeah, I know that, my average friend is not really into, and I can fall into the trap of being Mr. Pseudo-intellectual, even though I don't really like that term at all, because it implies that I would be an intellectual at all when I wouldn't be at all. But anyway.
I don't know. You sound like an intellectual.
Right. I've worked really hard. To make it sound that way. Yeah. I've found in these conversations, that there's a disconnect that happens when I mention these interests that I'm in, because it sounds so foreign to everyday life and it sounds so foreign to what people are actually going through. And I know, I imagine you might experience this as a professor, because there's sort of that idea that you're separated from like the rest of the world. And in that, I mean, it blows my mind in Capitalism and Desire, because it seems like there is such a, and I'm sorry if this comes off somewhat like offensive, but it seems kind of self-help at times, not in a way that's like, you know, you just need to believe in yourself and da-da-da-da-da. But book has literally helped me on personal levels, like in professional levels, especially because like, you breaking down capitalism and all this stuff is like, in a way that I can go, oh, okay, this is how I'm going to now approach my career in show business and my career in comedy. And it's helped immensely. And it's interesting that like, it is heady and it is this sort of intellectual thing. And you know, like you say, it's very theoretical. And yet when you get into it, there is this idea that, like, or this feeling like, oh no, this is actually coming from like a very deep, like personal place. Like it does seem to resonate that way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, that like warms the cockles of my heart that you said that. I don't take self-help as an insult at all. I mean, I mean, of course, the hope is that your book like isn't just like an academic, like hermetic to the academic world, you know, and that it actually can kind of go beyond that. So that's really, I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, that's sort of heartwarming.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah,
but go.
The segue, I guess, or the slight transition would be then like, how then? Because we're talking about capitalism and desire, and people have tweeted us about this podcast, and they've been like, talk more about this. When it comes to capitalism, I run into the trap where I feel like a college freshman who's read some quotes on like brainyquote.com or whatever. And when I start trying to talk about it, I feel like I hear myself and I'm like, oh, this is that annoying kid in college. And I'm sure that's my own like neurosis or whatever. But you talk a little bit about, not a little bit, you talk about this thing. I'm going to let you talk about it, but I'm going to tee it up for you and we'll see what happens. There's a scene in Drive. Okay, which is one of my favorite movies ever, and
great movie.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I have a buddy who hates it, and it almost ended our friendship. But
I can see.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. And I've
ended a friendship over a film disagreement.
It's worth it. There are less things to end a friendship over.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So there's the scene. Ryan Gosling is in the elevator. He sees that this guy means him harm. He beats him up, and rather than stopping when the guy is subdued, he just beats him to a bloody pulp. And then looks up, sees Carey Mulligan on the other side of the elevator door, and the door closes, separating Carey Mulligan and Ryan Gosling. Am I describing that scene correctly?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you, what is, if I were to talk about that scene in some way in relation to the economic system that we have, what would be the connection?
So what's great about that scene, I think, is that it shows our... And I think either in a footnote or actually in the text itself, I compare it to the scene at the end of Searchers, where John Ford's movie, where the door shuts and sort of leaves John Wayne outside, and we're inside, and sort of the violent guy is excluded, and we're part of the home, separated from the violence. And what I love about that scene is that. When the door shuts, the camera stays in the elevator, and it's as if he's totally excluded from her. And what's great about that movie is that it's clear that he's in love with her. And at that moment, though, I mean, I think there's a couple... I don't think I talk about this in the book, but what I love is that it rules out the possibility of him ever being with her.
Yeah.
Because of his his violence, like she sees that. And so I think it's a great scene about complicity, because the way the camera leaves us, you know, it stays in the elevator with him and then the door shuts, like in The Searchers, but we're on the side of the violent guy, not on the side of like community and whatever the inside the house and the civil, you know, like the civilized world. And so I feel like that really sort of captures the way capitalism has this effect of making us complicit in a way that, you know, and also it's violence too. I mean, that's sort of also present.
Yeah.
But yeah, like we're sort of stuck in the elevator. And so you do these things and you think like, oh, I'm doing this thing that's, I mean, this is, a lot of people have talked about this, but one of like your attempt to like, oh, I'm going to do this thing that's sort of outside the system. Well, then that's exactly what feeds the capitalist system itself, is people sort of thinking outside the box or trying to do something that, so everything ends up being sort of fitted back in.
Okay. All right. I think I kind of understand what you're saying. I think I get it. How does that relate to the gaze? Is it, because the way I tried to kind of, because I can, when I get confused, I can kind of pretend to understand things on like a tertiary level. But
yeah,
my understanding, and this is absolutely just me trying to wrap my head around it. The gaze and the idea that the door separating is, if I were to like try to break it down, it's like if I'm having a conversation with somebody and I'm like, hey man, you know, I don't think that this, without sounding too hippy-dippy, I don't think capitalism is necessarily the best thing for everybody, blah, blah, blah. The way I would try to explain that in relation to something like that would be like, it's very difficult to make a case for something like the violence of capitalism because you can't see any of really the negative effects, even though you know that they're there. Like when you're saying that like you wouldn't walk across the street for $1 million because you feel you're aware of the violence that it took to get all that you have. And I know on a personal level, I know about it, but I honestly can't say that I have any anxiety over it. And which is why I'm like, oh, that makes you such a great person you know, at least that's a very admirable thing. But it sounds like, so would I be just like, am I just still in the elevator, basically?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think, or you're just, so gaze is a great, I think gaze is such an important concept. So gaze is the point at which we recognize sort of our involvement in what we're seeing. So, and it also means that you have to sort of see things that you wouldn't ordinarily see, like the way in which, like, I'm talking to you on an iPhone right now, so I'm not that admirable.
Yeah, how dare you?
Of a subject. So, but what we don't see in the iPhone, you know, like I found it so maddening when Tim Cook came out with this condemnation of Donald Trump. He said Trump did something about. Said something about immigration, I think, or whatever. Some kind of ICE crackdown, and Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, comes out with some kind of moral, and I just thought, you know, I Tim Cook, whatever, but he's not in any position to be morally condemning anyone in the entire planet, you know, like Trump is a saint compared, like the minerals. If you you can just Google Congo cobalt and you can see what the mines look like where kids go to mine the cobalt that goes into every iPhone, you know, and then, you know, this, I talk about this Capital Desire, the nets that were outside of the Foxconn.
I used to work at, I'm sorry for calling you dude, but I.
No, that's
I work at.
I have 14-year-old twins. They call me dude all the time.
Okay, great. I'll blame it on being in Southern California for too long. But I used to work at it for a YouTube channel, which is where I got my start, I guess you could say. And it was a comedy news YouTube channel. And when that was happening, because we would go into work and we would cover the news for the day. And we would do like 5 videos a day, and it really resonated with people. And we were just like these like kind like baby comedy writers who didn't really understand anything. And I was basically considered the conservative one. And I remember that story and the nets and the suicide nets. And I vividly remember where I was. Like I remember reading that story, and I remember what the computer looked like. And like it's one of those things where like in Saving Private Ryan, when he's like, you know, you have to remember a specific memory to remember the surroundings. And I know that moment of like being like, wait a minute, they're putting in nets so that people won't like will survive if they jump off the building, and it's all for iPhones. Like, am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Yeah. That's absolutely correct. I think they've removed them now, and the conditions have slightly improved. But it's still an ethical disaster. You know, the iPhone. So
okay, yes.
And I just kind of personalized it with Tim Cook, but that's one of the things about capitalism is, and I think you've made this point already, that it sort of objectifies guilt so that you don't ever see, and you don't see the suffering that's caused, and also you're like, no one person is guilty, because so if Apple didn't do it, then some other company would do it.
That's the sad part.
You know, that's the thing. It's not like, oh, there's this other good company that's, you know, because that's the nature of the capitalist system, is that, you know, if there's a market, it's going to be filled with somebody who will do the thing for the cheapest. You know,
I wonder if that's why when like I get angry when I'm on Twitter and some of my peers are like, boycott this company for X, Y, and Z reason. And I'm like, well, like, I guess maybe boycott them. Like, sure. Like, you know, don't give them business, I guess. But also it's like, if another company is just going to do the exact same thing, or that's just the biggest company and all the companies below them are also doing that. And then when you know, if that company suffers, the next company, corporation.
I know. Isn't it interesting how it's sort of fashionable on the left to hate the, like, Google or whatever the big company is, but, and to like the little marginal one. But then if that little marginal company does really well and becomes then they'll be hated. 'Cause I remember when Google first started, I was at a party of, I never go to parties. So this was, I remember this well, just like you do the nets. I was at a party and, all sort of left-leaning English professors, and they were all like, Google is the greatest thing. It's such a great company. It's don't, you know, this don't, what is it, their slogan, like, don't be evil or don't be evil or, you know.
Reaction and formation. They
loved it. Yeah, right. That's great. And then, but now, of course, they all hate Google. So
that's funny. It's trendy. Whatever the newest thing is to hate is always very fun. It's a very powerless feeling. It feels very like, because I mean, like you're saying, you're on an iPhone, and I'm sure that if I was truly upset enough about these things and was able to stir up enough a kind of emotional response to these things, maybe I would not have an iPhone. But then it's like, then when I send somebody a text message, it's going to be green, and I can't have that, you know?
I know.
It's got to be blue, and I have priorities.
It's got to be blue, yeah. That's a great point.
All those, whatever, I don't know what they're mining to make those texts blue, but it's not good. If you had, so for people who are still listening and still kind of like, we're all over the place, obviously. What is if you were to summarize kind of what your sort of ideas are as much as possible, what's the message that you're trying to get out to people?
So you mean about capitalism and desire, or just sort of in general?
Just sort of in general. I mean, capitalism and desire, I would imagine it will relate to, but yeah, in general.
Yeah, so this actually touches on my more recent book on comedy. I would say the main thing that I sort of keep coming back to is the way in which loss is inseparable from enjoyment. And I think what's interesting, I mean, that touches on the capitalism thing too, because I feel like capitalism's promises, we can give you some enjoyment that's really has no connection with loss whatsoever. And that's the sort of capitalist dream. That's the promise of every commodity. And, you know, and I think that sort of my, if you want to put it in self-help terms, that's my main mantra to myself is every, you know, like there's no enjoyment without loss, like that loss is integral to it. And so you can't, so this attempt to have to enjoy yourself without if I could just get to this one point, no, you're not going to get to that point. So that's, you know, so it's really, I guess it's a philosophy about the priority of loss for us and the way that our satisfaction has to be tied up in that.
I think we'll end up doing at some point is having Peter on, because y'all's work is so, I mean, it parallels so well the idea of
right,
loss.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen any of his stuff? Have you?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's hard to understand because of his accent, but we try to give him a little, you know, we try to make it okay for him. I guess, as he struggles through. So you mentioned the book on comedy. Of course, I have to talk about that. My temptation, of course, will be to read it. And then, obviously, I'm going to do the exact same thing that I did with Capitalism and Desire, and I'm going to try to use it in my life. And I know the trap I'm going to fall into, which is going to be losing kind of the heart, and that's something I want to talk to you about a little bit in comedy as well. And I think I kind of have a loose understanding of what you are going to be talking about in that book. I haven't read it yet, but would you like to talk about it for a second?
Yeah, sure. So my basic idea is just that a situation or an event or a statement is comic when lack and excess come together in it. So that's basically my point. And then so I sort of look at different theories of comedy and how they kind of come close to getting that but don't quite get it. And then I look at just different jokes, different films. And if you look at the scenes that are funny, so like to me, Charlie Chaplin's that image of the little tramp is the great instance of this. So he wouldn't be funny if he just looked like a homeless person. Mm-hmm. But his look is funny because he is a homeless person who dresses as if he's a wealthy person.
Yeah.
So that figure of the little tramp is sort of, to my mind, sort of paradigmatic figure of comedy. So basically it was I have to say that I just gave a talk in Vancouver and I rated it a total success because the audience laughed.
Oh yeah.
Almost entirely. So the comedy book was basically a way for me to have a lot of jokes. And I have to say, it was the first book I've written that my mom, now she's not, I'm not going to be able to tell her that I did this because what I'm going to say is not totally positive. It's the first book that I wrote that she read the whole way through. So every other book she's like started and then, okay. you know. But she said, you finally wrote a good book to me.
Oh, that's sweet.
It was sweet. Yeah, it was sweet. Yeah. So, but it's because there's a lot of it has a lot of jokes in it, basically. So I spent a lot of time. I would tell students, and I taught a couple classes on comedy as I was preparing the book, and I had students. I said, look, if you come up with a good joke, I'll footnote you. Like I'll put the joke in, and I'll give you credit. So I have I don't know how many students, but the first joke in it is from a student and then a couple others.
Oh, that's great. So, that's very fun.
So it was great. So it was after class. I didn't have students asking me for like help with anything. They're just coming up to tell me jokes, which was
you nice. Made a couple of your students published comedy writers. It's fine. I'm a little jealous, but I'm happy for them. I think that's great.
Yeah.
So the lack and the excess thing, what is what's the last good comedic movie you saw?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I have a kind of, I think you're gonna think I have a low bar for comedy because
I doubt it.
I'm really looking forward to this one about the parents who try to stop their girls. Blockers. Yeah. Have you seen
it? No, but I've heard it's actually pretty good. I was very hesitant.
I've heard it's funny too. Yeah. I mean, this is going to be not current films, but my, son is into it in a teen film phase. Mm-hmm. And so we just watched Heathers, which I think has got to be one of the funniest films.
What was it?
Yeah. Do you know this movie?
Heathers.
No. Yeah. It's with Winona Ryder. It's sort of her first breakout.
Oh, no. Is that, no, that must
no,
have
No, it's a great, it's the best teen film ever made, I think.
But
recently, like, I think those sort of over the top ones like Hangover and Bridesmaids, I think are pretty great. I think, The Heat with Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock was pretty funny. So I have a kind of
good taste.
Although I think, I don't know about that. I think to me, the greatest comedy ever made, and a friend of mine and I did a podcast on this, is Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be.
Oh, okay.
Which you probably, I mean, no one has seen.
No, definitely not. I was going to say Dumb and Dumber, which is probably the same.
Yeah, I love Dumb and Dumber. Yeah.
I've found that in comedies, specifically movies, I get very bored in them very quickly, and I'm very, very critical of them, and I typically don't like them. And what I found especially is that I always get bored around the third act. I'm just like completely waiting for the thing to be over. And I wonder if that has to do with the lack and excess it narrowing or something, and like I see the resolution coming.
I think that's probably true, and so they seem like they're too far apart. But I think a lot of times these contemporary comedies are just crush you with excess, you know. Like they think, like I saw this one. Maybe you saw it with Scarlett Johansson, where they go, it's like Rough Night or Date Night. It's not Date Night. I think it's Rough Night, where they go on. It's like a bachelorette party.
Oh, I'm not. No, I don't think.
And it's just, you know, they it's all like drugs and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah. They like kill the stripper that's there. So it's, you know, so I think that they end up trying to be too excessive and sort of lose touch with the lack part.
I would love to know your thoughts on Game Night, if you ever get a chance to see that.
I love Game Night.
Okay, great.
That's what I should have said is the best recent comedy I saw. So that would be
it. I was hoping for that. Yeah. I was fishing for it, and I got it.
Yeah, no, you got it. I just didn't. I'm just too spacey to have have thought about it. But that is definitely the best recent comedy I saw. I sort of love Jason Bateman.
He's unbelievable.
I almost think he can't be in a bad movie. I mean, Horrible Bosses 2 was pretty
pushing it
bad,
yeah.
But you know, he's still in it, and so like that. I don't know if you saw that Spelling movie he was in, Spelling Bee movie.
I don't think I did. No.
It's called Bad Words, I think, but I thought that was pretty good. I mean, my favorite one with him, you probably don't either know it or like it, is the one where they're sitting Shiva.
You know, I did see it. Yeah, I actually did enjoy it. Yeah.
I thought that was pretty.
What was
and
that
again,
called?
I think
Adam Driver
called,
is in
This
it?
Is Where I Leave You.
Yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah, I thought, but I think he's so great in Game Night. I mean, just, you know.
Did you see Ozark? Have you watched that at all?
I haven't seen that.
So Ozark, it's a dramatic show.
It's dramatic.
Yeah, right. And very, very similar to Breaking Bad. And he directs a lot of the episodes, and it's just so good. I mean, it's fantastic. It's not Breaking Bad level, but it's up there.
Is it still, it's still going on, yeah?
It is, yeah. I think it got renewed for a second season. The first one's first one's out on Netflix, but yeah, I'd recommend it. Do you find that you have to watch every movie and be well versed in every movie in order to like
I kind of do. Yeah, I kind of do. I watch almost everything that comes out. Although television, I'm less, just because the commitment is so long to television shows that I end up more watching a film than watching television shows, which I know that's, I mean, if you wear the, I don't know what you think, but it seems like the greater achievements today are in television.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm a TV apologist or whatever you want to say. I love television. Yeah.
I just think that's the right position. I think I just my own timeline, it's hard for me to do that.
Yeah, I get that. What made you want to talk on comedy? Was it comedians? Was it growing up watching comedies as a kid with your parents? What was the source of that?
I think it was my parents. My mom she's funny. She's like, even though she was a fundamentalist, she was always ironic. You know, she was always, and so my spouse doesn't even, who's also a theorist, some psychoanalytic theorist, she like almost can't believe my mom is a true believer, because she, you know, whenever she says like she'll you know, she'll say like whatever, you know, like, yeah. I think God's has a, you know, God always has a, you know, that's sort of
sure,
dumb,
sure.
But she'll, whatever she says it in a kind of this ironic way. And so that really, she was funny. And so I tried to follow her.
And is she still Catholic? Is she still?
I think she's at an Episcopalian church, because she moved. So we live in Burlington, Vermont, and since we had twins, she retired and moved here. Which you would think, before I had children, I thought the last thing I ever want is my parent to live in the same city as me. And then after I had children, I'm like, how soon can you move here?
Oh yeah, you know? Yeah, I couldn't do it,
because twins are like, it's like, yeah, it's not. I would advise people not to have twins.
Well, with twins, I've heard there's two of them, and that's.
That's the problem. Right.
If they could fix that part, I feel like it would be a lot easier.
It'd be good.
I feel like I'm nowhere near the kid mark, but I can definitely feel, I don't know if there's some kind of, if it's in my head or if it's just getting older, but like I'm 31 and I'm now sensing that thing of like kids are just a little less gross to me now, and I'm pretty excited.
I mean this is a cliche, of course, but I'm glad I had, I mean, I was happy, but I sort of was like you. I was like, I don't know if I want to do it, and then when it happened, it was worse than I thought it would be.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, back to the book and the comedy and all that. Your theory on comedy is based in lack and excess, how those come together, how they're separate, and what are, I guess, other theories of comedy or of joke? Because joke writing and joke structure is something that I nerd out about a lot.
That's an interesting. So I basically talk about three. So there's Freud. Sort of famously wrote jokes in their relation to the unconscious, and his idea is that jokes and comedy economize. And I think there's, and so this, I don't think this is in contradiction to what I'm saying, but his idea is that, like, a pun, it's simplest with a pun. So a pun, you know, brings two meanings together, and so you get two for the price of one.
Yeah.
And so then that economy allows you to then expend this excess energy of laughing. So it's a pretty fascinating.
What about when I say a pun and then people get mad at me because I said
a pun? Well, then so if it's like a too stupid of one, like the, like, what's black and white and red all, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really bad.
Yeah.
Right. Then Freud's idea would be that there isn't a savings at all where people expected a savings. So thus the groan would be, oh, I thought I was going to get this kind of, you know, economization. Instead, I didn't get it because it's too, like, the paths are too worn. So it's actually not bringing together.
After you, please.
No, go ahead. Okay. I think you're going to.
So I have one of my favorite jokes is from Pete Holmes, and it, I started thinking about it because I was just in Indianapolis, and my brother and sister-in-law and my parents all showed up and surprised me because I was doing a comedy show out there, and it was really sweet. And it was incredibly cold, and we were driving around walking to a bar that we heard about on this trolley tour that we did. We did a tour of Indianapolis that my mom was very sweet and got us tickets for. And so if you ever want to know anything about Indianapolis, you know, shoot me an email.
Okay. I will take you.
Yeah. They're second only to Washington, D.C. in terms of war monuments. So there you go. This guy points at this bar. And so later we're like, well, let's go to that bar. And it starts snowing and we're freezing and we're getting mad at the, you know, jokingly angry at the trolley tour guide for telling us about this bar. And we started kind of quoting a tag from one of Pete Holmes' jokes. And so Pete Holmes has this joke where he says, this party is McDonald's, and he says it's like the surest way to kill the rhythm of a room or to kill the environment. And I'm going to butcher it, obviously, because you have to do that. But and then somebody said, you know, you say, oh, this party is McDonald's, and then you say nothing, and then somebody says, what do you mean by that? And then you go, oh, I'm loving it. And then the joke is that the person then goes, fuck you, sir, fuck you. And so anyway, the reason
I don't get it.
Think basically it's so annoying. The joke is so annoying. It's a guy at a party who's like, this party's McDonald's, and then somebody's like, what do you mean by that? And then he goes, I'm loving it. It's basically a trolling joke, like he's just trolling the people around him.
And so
people then get angry at him, and it made me think about that in terms of like there was this guarantee of a savings, there's this guarantee of like you're gonna say something funny or you're gonna say something that explains this in a way that is clever and good and not something that I would have thought of, but instead it's the most baseline thing. And it sounds like almost like a version of
exactly
that,
exactly what Yeah, but what's interesting is it's possible to turn, like, what he's doing is turning the failed joke into itself.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. I think is a great thing. I think, like, to me, those are some of the best jokes are the when you turn the because you're actually like using the thing that it, like, it's almost like recycling, right? Like you're taking the thing that had become stale and giving it you know, re-energizing.
Yeah, I love it. It's a fantastic, it's one of my favorite, my favorite jokes. My favorite joke of all time is, Gary Shandling has a joke where he is at the microphone and he says, you know, I told my therapist, that I think my mother is in love with me. This joke isn't going to come across because it's a podcast. He goes, I told my therapist that, I think my mother is in love with me, and he did something that I've only ever seen, therapists and blackjack dealers do. And he steps away from the microphone and he claps his hands together and he shows both of his hands and then just walks off the stage. And I think that's far and away my favorite joke. And I wish I could, it'd be better if I could, you know, show you.
You could show
it. Yeah, exactly. Right. But anyway, so those are the two jokes that I thought about in relation to, you know, what you were talking about.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect. Yeah.
So
anyway, so the other theory, so Henri Bergson, around the same, so 1905, he wrote his book, and Freud's was like 1902 or 1903, comes up with this theory that comedy occurs when something that's living is mechanized, so it becomes mechanical. And it's interesting that the Charlie Chaplin film Modern Times, I don't know if you probably have seen the beginning part, if you haven't seen the whole thing, but maybe not.
Yeah, maybe, if I've, okay. I don't know.
Okay, so he's on an assembly line and gets kind of like automated, and then he goes sort of into the machine that he's working
on. Yeah.
Anyway, so the point is that that's sort of the greatest example of Bergson's theory, even though it's 20 some years after he wrote the theory. But any time we're so he thinks that's the source. Like, comedy is art, sort of the revenge of the living on its being turned into something mechanical. Like your example of the McDonald's joke would be that. So something had, it's talking about the, it's like making this sort of, we expect something living, and he just gives us this mechanical kind of
response. Oh, yeah, okay,
response,
I got you,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So, and then there, this other sort of more recent theory is by this, another psychoanalytic theorist named Alenka Zupancic. And her idea is that comedy occurs when a universal is made manifested in the actual world. Like, so if we see, her example is like a Bushism would be a great example. So when George, either of the Bushes, right? I think they both had these. When they say something that's, you know, ridiculous, like, we see this is what it is, this is what the ruler really is, right? So this sort of revelation of what this supposedly like high transcendental figure gets, this is what it really is.
Yeah, behind the curtain, peeking behind the curtain kind of thing.
Yeah. So those are the sort of basic.
I love that. I like that one a lot.
Theories. That's a great theory. She's a really smart. It's a really good theory. And her book is called The Odd One In, which is even a funny.
Oh, that's great.
Title. Yeah, because it's, you know, instead of The Odd One Out, it's The Odd One In.
Yeah.
So it's.
Yeah. There's a two for one for you. Yeah, I think about that with our current president, and I have such a weird fondness for him, and I know I'm not supposed to because I'm supposed to be angry at him all the time, but I don't have.
No, I know, but comic wise,
God, it's unbelievable. It's just,
and
I don't write Trump jokes. I don't like Trump jokes, but just because I think it's so hard to do a good one now, and maybe it is because it is the universal thing. It's like it's hard to write a joke that it's like everybody gets it. Like, you know what the punchline is. He's an idiot, or he's a bad guy.
Right. I mean, that's a great point that comedy requires. I mean, I think it's interesting because it's, on the one hand, it's universalizing. Like, you know, it sort of invites everyone to be in on the joke. But if everyone gets the joke right away, then it's not.
Yeah.
It's not funny. You know, like, there's a kind of, I mean, that's maybe the conservative dimension of comedy, that it has to kind of exclude people.
Do you find that your understanding of comedy is like, do you find that it affects your outlook on the world, like it, when it comes to stuff like politics and world affairs and like all that stuff? Like, do you find yourself just going like, hey, this is just ridiculous? Like, and do you find yourself able to kind of not you know, use it as a way to not take everything quite so seriously?
Well, here's what I would say about that. Like, I have, you know this famous, like, too soon of a...
Yeah.
So one of the things I say in the book is, okay, too soon is bad, but too late is far worse. you know, so like, you know, cause if you tell a joke to I give this example of a joke, like, some joke about Julius Caesar being stabbed. I mean, it wouldn't be funny cause no one cares about Caesar, you know? So, right. So that would be a joke that's too late. And I feel like, but this is a roundabout way of answering the question. Like, I feel like the one thing that I sort of feel like that theory has maybe taught me is that jokes aren't a way of not being, they're not a way of not being serious. They're actually a way of being serious, like a way of really approaching.
Oh, interesting.
Something.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, I really, really, really balk at people who say, like, I have students sometimes will say, you can't joke about that. And I'll be like, no. Like, that's the way that you actually approach it.
Right.
Like, that's the way, that's not a way of, like, not approaching.
That's
a way of really engaging.
Yeah.
And so part of the thing I do in this book is I sort of distinguish between comedy and pathos. And I feel like one of the things that I see about our contemporary sort of social and political situation is we relate to each other so much through pathos and not through comedy. And it's because I think we see the other as just this purely lacking being rather than also as an excessive being. So I guess I feel like it's worse to just feel like someone else is pathetic and just feel bad for them than to laugh at them. Like, I feel like you'd rather be laughed at, like, not like laughing with you, but really laughed at,
yeah,
than have someone to feel sorry for you. So that's I guess one way that it's sort of informed the way I think about
that is that, that's the best. That's fantastic. Holy crap. That's amazing. I loved every second of that. I wish I could rewind what you just said and listen to it again.
Okay.
Big fan. Holy crap. That was amazing. This is a thing too, where in your, you know, writing style, you do tend to be able to convey things that are very, I mean, you know, not saying that that was incredibly complex, but the ideas of capitalism and all that stuff, your way of speaking is fantastic.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really, really think, I hate jargony stuff. I've just always hated it. And I just feel like if it's not, the reason is really kind of stupid. Like, I'm a kind of simple-minded person, and so I have to translate, like, if I read Hegel, I have to translate it into my own kind of simple vernacular, and so then that's what I write in.
That makes sense. Yeah, yeah, that's...
So it's just me. It's just my own, like, that's my level, and so... You know.
In regards to the, or in response to the too soon thing, I had a thing where I tweeted something after after the Louis C.K. scandal broke out, and it was a response from the internet that, you know, I have an audience that's very like, they kind of like, they know I'm going to screw up and they can kind of look out for me. And basically all the responses were like, delete, 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 like delete this, delete this, delete this. And I was like, I'm not going to delete it. And then I replied to the tweet.
It was a tweet. Is that
what
it was?
It was a tweet. And, I made a joke about what he did, and I basically said something along the lines of like, man, he's such a funny comedian that even the way he does these horrible things is kind of hilarious. And I said it in a way that was way more not appropriate. And I ended up eventually deleting it because, for one, my therapist told me to, because he wants me to make money and have a career. And
So that would have interfered with your like possible getting a show on whatever.
It could, and colleges and like all that. And I was about to go, I was about to do this thing called NACA, which is for colleges, which did not go well because for the exact same reason, I think I said things that I wasn't supposed to say, even though it was nothing bad. It was just, you know, that there's a you've heard of hypersensitivity and political correctness on college campuses.
I have heard of that. Yeah.
I'm sure it never comes up.
Actually, what's interesting is I mean, I'm a kind of, I think I'm a pretty offensive guy, and I understand. I mean, I've heard Chris Rock won't perform on college campuses, and I understand that. But I guess part of it is, I think people come to the University of Vermont to ski, and so even though it's a really left-leaning campus, I don't seem to offend students. They think it's kind of funny.
Well,
so
and
maybe I'm.
They're also exercising, so they're getting. Their blood is flowing, and they're not. Hopefully, they have endorphins, and they're not taking everything so dang seriously. Sorry, I cut you off. Were you about to say something there?
No, it's fascinating to me that you had to delete it to like.
Well, and I also I deleted it too because I have a joke. I've written jokes that have turned out to be kind of in the similar styles to certain of my comedian people that I look up to, which is a part of finding your voice. But some of them I just really like the jokes. There's a one that is Anthony in the style of Anthony Jeselnik. Are you familiar with him?
I don't know.
He's a very offensive comic, and he does these kind of one-liner jokes that always have these fun little twists at the end that are usually dark and make him look like a maniacal psychopath. And it's really, he's a hysterical joke writer, and he just uses comedy as a way of writing very funny, very dark jokes. And I wrote a joke where I say I was in Florida. I'm from Florida. And I said the last time I was in Florida, I was driving around with my dad, and he pointed at a car, he pointed at a house, and he goes, "You see that house right there? The man in that house was just arrested for plotting to kill his wife and three kids." And I said, "Dad, this is why I moved, because no one in this town has any follow through." And it's a, you know, I'm like, oh, the guy should have just killed his. And it was a very Jeselnik-y joke. But the problem is, like, that's not my typical style of comedy. And with that tweet that I deleted, it was a very, like, it was so, you know, that style, so abrasive and so quick and so calloused, that it didn't match the rest of the tone that I typically have online. I would love if you have any feedback on this, but it's like sometimes I forget that I have a luxury in when I'm performing stand-up that is to a crowd of people in a dark club where, you know, you're saying these things and people are laughing and they're not being held accountable for it. Whereas on the internet, it's this public, bright blue, black and white display of just total, total terrible thing.
Yeah. My question is, deleting it actually makes it go away. So like, you're not like, I thought people are sometimes like held responsible for even their deleted.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, tweets. They could find it. Yeah. If you wanted to find it, you could find it. I mean, I'm very like, I kind of think I related to what you're saying where you're like, I feel like I'm an offensive guy, but nobody ever gets super mad at me. And I think that's I've been fortunate enough to, in my little hole, fall into that kind of thing, but people still get upset, but nothing like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's that separation or that, that like, thing of like, oh no, there is a thing to the comedy club that I do love, that like dark, dingy environment where you're like, oh, there. But then you also get the comics who use that as an excuse to, like you were saying, do the excess thing where it's just like disgusting thing after disgusting thing. And I'm like, well, this isn't fun. Right.
I don't think that's funny. I don't think that's fun. I mean, I think you have to be able to like your joke. I think what's great about that joke is, so it's excessive because obviously the guy's, you want him to kill his whole family, but then the lack is he doesn't do it, right? Like, so that's
okay, great.
Do you
find so yourself now when you hear jokes, are you like, checks out like
I do? Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting because I mean this is true of any theory, right? Like, I constantly am getting either messages, emails, or students will say, I think this disproves your theory. You know, because all it takes is one exception.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm constantly getting this.
That sounds exhausting. So. Have you found one yet that it's kind of made you?
I haven't found one, so I feel like I've been able to sort of fend off all of the attacks. So I feel pretty confident about it. But you know, I mean, in a certain sense, that's true about every theory, right? Like if you, like. Like Karl Popper, do you know who that is? He's like a mid-century. He wrote this book called *The Open Society and Its Enemies*, which attacks Plato, Hegel, and Marx. But he hated Freud, and he thought the problem with psychoanalysis is it's not falsifiable, right? Like, there's no, because you can always say, well, it's just unconscious, so that the person, like what they did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's like that's just he didn't say this like this, but he's like, that's a bullshit theory because it can't. Whereas a scientific theory, you do a test, the test doesn't work out, then you know the theory is wrong. And so I kind of feel like every theory really is not falsifiable on it, because you can always kind of make the thing fit. So some people, they'll come to me with these things, they'll be like, well, I think there's kind of lack here, and there's a, and they're like, oh, I guess, but you know, so I feel like I almost would say that's true of every theory.
Interesting.
Like you can't. Yeah.
Yeah, because it isn't like the typical scientific method, right? Because you can't go in a lab and test whether or not the unconscious is dictating everything.
Right, and even, you know, like I would even say, okay, so for individual scientific hypotheses, that they're falsifiable, clearly, but like the larger theory, is it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, is quantum mechanics falsifiable? I don't know. Is I mean, think about like neo-Darwinist explanations for behavior. Like, they're completely not falsifiable.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the same, like men have a lot of affairs. Steven Pinker says, oh, it's because when we were like 20,000 years ago, whatever, men had to, they're trying to propagate their seed as far as they can, you know, like, okay. But then, you know, you could, that could explain everything, you know, like, or it could explain the opposite. It's like they're monogamous. You could just think about this. Well, men are always monogamous because they want to pick out the exact perfect woman to propagate their, you know,
yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah, like you could always do So that I find that mad.
I heard this this like crackpot theory. Maybe it's not crackpot. Maybe it's totally true. But it was like, you know, the amount of time that the in love period lasts is, you know, 8 to 10 months, and the gestation period for a human baby is 8 to 9 months. So basically, what happens is the husband, you know, they have sex, and then there's love, and they're in love, and it's this magical time, and it lasts for as long as the pregnancy, and then the male's out of there so that the female doesn't have to be protected anymore once she has the baby. Which, and I'm like, okay, like what, like, all right, like there's no.
Yeah, but also that doesn't make any sense, because if the whole point is to protect the gene, then the male's out of there, that's not really going to protect the gene as it tries to, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I find those.
There's a lot of, a lot of stuff like that where I'm just like, and where people can, especially when they're into this stuff, they can come at me with it. And even I'm like, because I love it. I'm like, I was like, you know, it's my nerd area. But I, when they come at me with it, I'm like, I don't care. I don't care what the, I don't care what you were. What you're saying, and I don't know why that is. And I think it like the thing about the psychoanalysis stuff, because I've talked with Pete about this a lot, where it's like, how is this any different than a religion that you're supposedly leaving? Like, how is it, because you're believing in it, it's all powerful, it's, you know you have this kind of can't control it, and you can view it in all these different ways, and it's, I don't know, like it, and you can't prove that it's not there, just like a god. But then I'm like, I read stuff on psychoanalysis, and I'm like, oh, this just, it just speaks, like I was saying about the Capitalism and Desire book, where it's like, it just speaks to me on a level that like just does click, like it makes sense on a level that that seems to me, or at least it seems to feel a little beyond like being like, well, I don't know if it's like, all right, whatever.
Yeah I really feel that way. I also feel like it doesn't, I mean, that you know, it I guess it has an for me, it has an explanatory power that like a religious explanation is the opposite of an explanation. It's like, it just is because it is, right? And so I feel like it, like the notion of the unconscious really has a lot of, you know, I guess like what you're saying, I guess it was true for me. Like it ended up being, that just, it seemed like it made a lot of sense.
Right.
And that's, I guess that's why you accept, I mean, I would say that's why one accepts whatever theory one accepts, right?
Yeah. You're like, oh, this makes sense to me. All right.
It makes sense to me. Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Todd. I really appreciate it. We end every episode with some sort of a takeaway, some sort of a summary. I'm gonna start, and then I'm gonna say some words for a couple seconds, and then if you want to say some words that are bound to be more profound, then that would be great too. I want to, I guess my big takeaway is that for sure too soon is way better than too late, and I don't feel bad for deleting a tweet for professional purposes, but I will be making more offensive jokes in the future, and when I do, at least they're offensive and not just simply irrelevant. Would be a more terrifying thing. Yeah. That's my big grandiose takeaway on this very, very good episode. What about you?
No, I think that's my favorite point too.
Okay.
We covered. Yeah, that better to be offensive than to be irrelevant. I think that's
I'm going to put that on.
And also, I guess the other thing I would say is that the joke is a way to approach things seriously. And just to tie back to capitalism a minute, I think capitalism is not funny. So,
oh,
because
good.
It separates lack, like it separates lack from access. Like you have the toil of the workday, and then you have, you go home, get drunk, go to an orgy, do coke, whatever you do, right? And then you go back to work and have the toil. So it's constantly separating the two, and it promises that you can have excess without lack. I mean, that's the capitalist promise.
Wow.
So and that's what I would say. So that's how I would connect the whole, all the dots, maybe.
Beautiful. I could keep going, but we're gonna wrap it up, and would love to have you back on when Pete is back.
I would love any time.
Awesome.
Anytime.
Well, thank you, Todd. I really appreciate it, and thank you for doing this.
I had a great time.
Awesome.